Up next, seeing through the hype in medical news. Here's what I mean. To get us going, let me give you a little bit of a quiz here. What do you think your risk of developing colon cancer is? See if you can guess which one of these statistics is true. Is it A, colon cancer will strike 150,000 Americans? B, colon cancer will strike 53 out of 1,000 people? Or C, colon cancer will strike 5 of 10,000 people? The answer is all of the above. They are all true, given the right context. And it is a trick question, but it illustrates how statistics can be misleading when it comes to understanding health risks. And my next guests have written a book to help you slice through the stats, to understand what your real risks are, and to help you avoid becoming panicked with every new public service announcement about something and how to read through those statistics. Stephen Wollaschen is a general internist in the Department of Veterans Affairs in White River Junction, Vermont. And he's also a professor at Dartmouth Medical School and co-director of the Center for Medicine and Media at Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. He has co-authored a book called Know Your Chances, Understanding Health Statistics. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Hi.
Lisa M. Schwartz is a professor at Dartmouth Medical School and a general internist at the Department of Veteran Affairs. And she's also with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
What is your takeaway message? I'll start at the end of the interview and say, what is the takeaway message of your book today, Lisa?
I think the first thing is to ask questions, mm-hmm. because behind many of the health messages, there are two things. There are numbers and there's science. And we want you to understand what the numbers are behind the message and whether you should believe the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, in the basic numbers, pretty much when you're deciding about something are, what are my chances if I do this, and what are my chances if I don't do this?
Mm-hmm. When you and Steve were thinking about writing this book, did you say we need to create a manual for the public here? Is this something for the public, or do you have to have some sort of background to understand these concepts?
Now, this book is meant for the general public. Mm-hmm. We don't need to have any background other than just what your skills you bring to it, because people deal with numbers all the time, and the kinds of numbers you hear in health messages and drug ads and public service announcements are really no different than the kind of numbers you hear all the time when you go to a store and there's a sale, or when you have to calculate mm-hmm. the tip at a restaurant. So people have the skills. The problem is helping them to engage those skills mm-hmm. when they see these messages.
Well, let's talk about some of these messages, because we're bombarded with them all the time. When we watch television, there's a problem. When we go to the doctor, when we hear public service announcements, when we're told ask your doctor about this medicine or medication, we're going to get to those kinds of questions. So stay with us. We're going to talk to Steve Wollaschen and Lisa M. Schwartz about their book, Know Your Chances: Understanding Health Statistics, How to See Through the Hype in Medical News, Ads, and Public Service Announcements. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-8255. Your calls. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about medical statistics, how to know your chances. That's the title of a new book, Know Your Chances, Understanding Health Statistics, authored by Steve Wollaschen, Lisa Schwartz, and H. Gilbert Welch. And Steve and Lisa are with us in our studios here. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's talk about some of these cases. What would be a good case, Steve, to bring up that illustrates how we can get – we have to really understand the messages and how we might be getting mixed messages?
Well, some of the most – obvious examples are with drug ads. You know, we're all seeing drug ads all the time. And a lot of times the problem with a drug ad is that it doesn't provide you with the most fundamental information you need to make decisions about the drug.
Let me bring up one for example. There's one sure. in your book about for Lunesta.
Yes.
Right? The Lunesta is the drug that is supposed to help you sleep. And it's
right.
it lists the possible side effects, including drowsiness, a funny taste in your mouth. Seems clear to me. What's wrong with that ad?
Well, the problem is it doesn't tell you how well the drug works. You'd want to know what's my chance of falling asleep easily or without a problem if I don't take the drug, and what is it if I do take the drug. If you look at the ad, you think, well, I'll take this pill, the Luna Moth will appear, and next thing I know I'll be asleep for 8 hours and then wake up refreshed in the morning. The problem is if you look at the actual data from the studies that were done, that were submitted to the FDA, that were the basis for FDA approval for the drug, you find that compared to taking a sugar pill, on average, people will just fall asleep about 15 minutes sooner than people who take Lunesta. And you only sleep about 40 minutes longer, which doesn't sound like, you know, the miracle that the ad seems to imply. And then there are side effects. About 6% of people are drowsy the next day, which is sort of ironic. If you're taking the drug so you'll sleep well at night, you want to feel refreshed in the day. But in fact, you may feel sleepy the next day.
Well, it does warn you that you will feel drowsy. But when you read that, you see the ad, you think, well, it's a sleeping pill. Of course, I'm going to feel drowsy. You're saying you're going to feel drowsy the next day, which is not the impression you get from the ad.
Right. The impression from the ad is you get a full night's sleep and you're up and ready to go in the morning.
Interesting. Do you agree, Lisa, that these ads can be very misleading at times?
Yeah, I mean, I think that because generally the ads don't provide any numbers, and so that leads people to assume that these drugs work really well for everybody who takes them. And I think that that's the most basic question to ask is, what happens if I take this drug and what happens if I don't take this drug? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you mentioned that there's a lot of side effect information. That's true. There is a lot of side effect information, but that information isn't prioritized. And so it's hard for somebody to know which of these side effects really are related to the drug, meaning how much more often do they occur than kind of the background level of these common symptoms. And so we think it's really important to get, you know, more focused information about side effects. One, are there any life-threatening side effects? And the other, what are the important symptom or bothersome side effects?
And you recommend for this drug, especially in particular in the book, you recommend that the package insert should be changed in a much easier to read form, more understandable, has all the things in perspective.
Well, not just the packet insert. We think that the manufacturer of the drug, if they're allowed to advertise the drug, ought to ensure that the information gets to the people who might use it. And we think the best way would be to have the FDA prepare these simple tables that we show in the book that tell you what's the chance of whatever the drug is for, what's the chance of experience that if you take the drug or if you don't take the drug. And similarly, what are the chances of the important side effects, prioritized in the way that Lisa mentioned.
You say in your book, quote, if there were a hall of fame for exaggeration, survival statistics would get a lifetime achievement award.
That's a great line.
Well, you wrote it, right?
Yeah.
Well, aside from the fact that it was a great line, why do you mean that? What do you mean by that? We really confuse these survival statistics, don't we?
Yeah, and by survival statistics, I mean stuff – usually we're talking about like screening tests. So, for example, you're in New York. In New York City, there were a lot of ads in the subway and elsewhere about a lung cancer screening trial. It said a simple test that can save your life. And it implied that if you're a smoker or a former smoker, if you go for CAT scans periodically of your lungs looking for cancer, it'll save your life. And those claims are backed up by studies which show that people who are screened with lung cancer, with CAT scans, survive longer than people who don't. The problem is that the statistic can be a little confusing. And the reason is that it's like when you look at survival, it's from the time of diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So if you have a CAT scan, you may have a tumor that's very, very small, that's not causing any symptoms, that eventually would cause symptoms. But if you have the CAT scan, it gets picked up early. If you didn't get the CAT scan and time goes by and the tumor enlarges, eventually causes symptoms, you'd be diagnosed later. The problem is that if nothing else changed, people diagnosed with the CAT scan seem like they live much longer than people who don't. And that's
even if they die at exactly the same minute.
It's like an optical illusion. It's like Barry Kramer, the editor of the Journal of National Cancer Institute, used the analogy of like when Nell was tied to the tracks in Snidely Whiplash, you're giving her binoculars so she can see the train from further down the line. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem, but there's a way around the problem. And the way around the problem is to look at mortality, how many people actually die from these diseases. And if you look in the trials that are done for screening tests, and unfortunately we don't have – one yet with CAT scan screening, although there will be one shortly providing data. But if you look at the trials with, like, for example, with regular x-rays, chest x-rays, it turns out that while people seem to live longer based on the spurious survival statistic, they're just as likely to die. And that's the bottom line. CAT scan screening may help, may not help, but we won't know for sure until these trials are done.
Mm-hmm. So we have to be careful for watching the survival statistics so that we don't confuse mortality with survival rate and things like that. We have to know what we're looking at.
But especially when we're talking about whether screening works, that's the place where this is very misleading, because survival statistics can be helpful in other settings, mm-hmm. like if you're testing a new chemotherapy agent. It's not that it's always misleading, but it's always misleading to make some judgment about whether a screening test has any value.
Mm-hmm. It has to be one. It has to be measuring not apples and oranges. It has to be measuring the same things.
Exactly.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255. Let's get a call in from Bob in Wilmington. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm wondering if the authors discussed the difference between absolute risk and relative risk in regard to things like claims a drug maker may make, like about the reduction of cardiovascular events in a big trial or something like that.
Well, sure. Lisa, David, go ahead.
Sure. And this is something that you actually often see that in some of the recent cholesterol-lowering ads, there was a big headline that says, you know, this drug will reduce your chance of dying from a heart attack by a third, which may sound very big, but the problem is, if you know, a third of what? So if it's a third of a big number, then that's a big benefit. If it's a third of a small number, it's a small benefit. It's exactly like if you went to a store and there was a sale and they said you could have 50% off any one item. If you were smart, you'd choose a really expensive item and save a lot of money rather than a really cheap item and save very little. So whenever you hear or see a message that talks about a reduction in relative terms, you always have to ask of what. Otherwise, you can't know whether it's a big or a small difference.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Steve, where should people go if they want some unbiased information about these drugs and things like
well,
that?
Well, for drugs, It can be a little tricky because it's not always easy to find this information. If you have some energy, one thing that you can do is go to the FDA's website. The FDA has a website where you can type in the name of the drug and you get to a place where you can actually look at all the information that the reviewers looked at when they were deciding whether or not to approve the drug. And that has all the information from all the trials that were submitted of the drug. The problem is that getting that information, you know, you have to slog through a lot of stuff. So one thing that we've been encouraging FDA to do, and we're working with them on a project to try and do this, is to have the drug reviewers actually fill out tables, like we mentioned earlier, tables that show side by side what's the chance of the outcome, the thing that the drug is for, if I take the drug, and what's the chance if I don't take the drug, and also the harm information also side by side.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Lisa, do you have an example in the book, another example of coping with these varying statistics that you'd like to point out?
Well, I think the ad that we use in the book is the Zocor ad for mm-hmm. Preventing heart attacks. And that's another example where the ad uses a big relative change. And when you look at the actual numbers, that they're much smaller. One of the things we also think is really important is because people aren't used to seeing these numbers very often, that sometimes in medicine, the differences that something makes in absolute terms may be sort of small. Let's say the difference between 3% and 2% dying mm-hmm. with a drug. And it's important to realize that if we're talking about a very important outcome like dying, that even a 1% difference can be really important. So that there's more to understanding the numbers than just understanding the magnitude. It's understanding what that thing is that you're preventing and how important it is to you.
Mm-hmm. There was something about Crestor in the news lately, I've heard you speak about this, the research on that. Could you give us a little thumbnail sketch of that, Lisa?
Well, in the Crestor study, they were taking people who had normal cholesterol by current standards and then seeing whether their C-reactive protein level was mm-hmm. higher than 2, and if they were higher than 2, then they were randomized to either get Crestor or not, and the trial was stopped early because there was a reduction in an outcome that combined, so you could have any one of 3 things, and it was stopped short of 2 years because it was felt that this benefit was substantial. And what you've heard us talk about was the idea that it's very hard to know exactly what that study means because this was a low-risk group, and what they showed was that any one of those things were reduced, and one of those things were hospitalizations. And, you know, it ranges from hospitalization to death. And mm-hmm. we don't know how much of the effect is on hospitalization and how much is on death. And the second thing is with any new drug, the LDL cholesterol is being lowered to, I think the average was 55 in the group of people who took Crestor. And so we don't know over the long term what's going to happen to people who have an LDL of 55, the bad cholesterol of 55, for a long period of time. And so which is an important point that in the book, which is that, you know, new drugs are appealing because they're new and exciting, but also new drugs and new strategies are also something to be concerned about because we just know less about what happens. Mm-hmm.
And the book we're talking about is called Know Your Chances, Understanding Health Statistics, How to See Through the Hype in Medical News, Ads, and Public Service Announcements. So my guests are Stephen Wallachin and Elisa Schwartz, who are co-authors along with H. Gilbert Welch. And we're going to take a little ID break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. And come back and talk more about this book. And we have a lot of folks who'd like to get in and ask questions. So let's see how we can go on this. Let's go to Mark in Chicago. Hi.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was just wondering if your guest could comment on the little piece you did on third-hand smoke with almost no statistics and suggesting that the Surgeon General would somehow put a policy in place because mm-hmm. they can detect a little trace of something in children's urine.
That's why I asked him three times if he had any evidence for this.
And he didn't, and you didn't seem to say, well, this just sounds like a little pet theory. I mean,
you got the message yourself, it seemed.
Pardon?
It seems like you got the message.
Well, yeah, okay. I suppose that's true.
I'm not giving opinions about whether it's a pet theory, and I'm just giving you the facts, ma'am, sir.
I guess that sounds legit then, but it didn't seem to me like you were questioning him much. It sounded much more like you were letting his statement stand scientific argument.
Well,
something that probably shouldn't even have been bothered to be talked about.
Well, it was published, and if we give it a little bit of airing, maybe someone will come up with a good answer for us.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
Okay. Is that your point? Let me get a comment from our guests, Steve, Lisa.
Well, I mean, I think it's the point is well taken that it's important when we discuss medical research to be really clear about, you know, one, what are the risks that we're talking about, and what are some of the numbers? What's the chance of these bad things happening if you do something, if you're exposed, in this mm-hmm. case, to secondhand smoke, or if you're not? So giving some numbers are important because then the listener can get a sense of, well, how worried should I be? How scared should I be? And how does this risk compare to other things? So you have some context. So, for example, I don't know if he has numbers, and I agree that you tried to get them out of him. But if he had some numbers, then you could sort of compare them. Well, what's the chance with firsthand smoke? Mm-hmm. You know, smoking, this is something we have in the book. We have these charts which sort of show you what's the effect on your chance of dying from all causes in the next 10 years if you're a smoker or not. It's a pretty remarkably large effect. It's about the equivalent of adding about 5 to 10 years of life to your age. Mm-hmm. Getting the numbers is really important, and it's hard for you and it's hard for the researcher, but it's really good that the listener was cued into that.
But listeners, and I'll just speak for the general public, likes to hear black and white things. You know, they don't want to hear, you know, you have to do your homework if you want to find out for yourself what the truth about these things, as much as they don't like to hear that when, you know, you talk about what do I talk to my doctor about.
It's true, and I think it's hard, especially with the broadcast media, to get a lot of numbers in. But, you know, when we have an election, for example, though, we will say the numbers, right? We'll say Obama got 53% and McCain got 48%. They won't just say, you know, McCain lost or something. So, but it's hard. Your medium is much harder than print medium for getting the numbers out.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you, besides reading your book, what do you tell people about making these judgments? I mean, they just have to – this is part of what everyday life is about. You have to do it for yourself.
Well, no. I mean, I think the first thing is to ask their doctor. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it's not the idea that people are on their own, but I think it's about just asking. So the doctor saying, oh, you should take this drug because you have, you know, your bone density is a little bit low, not quite, you know, osteoporosis. So then you say, you know, well, you know, how big is my risk of having a hip fracture in the next 10 years? And how much is it going to lower this? And do we even know, are there even studies that say that this is definitely beneficial to somebody like me? And so I think just by opening up that dialogue with the doctor and asking those questions, then people can understand, they can begin to understand whether it's worth it for them to take a pill. Because for things, you know, where we're trying to, you know, reduce the chance of something bad happening, it's all about the data, right? It's nothing you can feel in yourself, like with a symptom drug. You can't have, you have no chance at deciding whether this works for me, because you won't know that you didn't have something because of you took the drug, or that you avoided, you know, you can't know that. And so that's why the numbers really matter for things where we're reducing risk.
All right, we're going to take a short break, come back, talk more with Steve Olishan and Lissa Schwartz, authors of Know Your Chances, Understanding Health Statistics. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, Twittering at SciFry, and in Second Life. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about understanding risk with the authors of a book, Knowing Your Chances, Understanding Health Statistics, How to See Through the Hype in Medical News Ads and Public Service Announcements. My guests are Steve Olishan and Lisa M. Schwartz. And right at the beginning in Chapter 1, you start out with a sort of little quiz, a little sign up there. It says, the early warning signs of colon cancer, colon, you feel great, you have a healthy appetite, you're only 50. That sounds pretty scary, because everybody feels like that. That's scary. If those are the early warning signs, then I'm pretty scared.
Right. So, you know, the good news is you're healthy. The bad news is you're going to die from colon cancer. Right.
Now, is that an actual warning?
Well, that's an actual ad. That's mm-hmm. That was an ad from Sloan Kettering there where you are, and it was in the New York Times Magazine. So that's a real ad, and that's a strategy that a lot of people use to market ideas, not just drug companies, but in this case an academic medical center, you know, to have a scary message, to try to scare people into doing something. In this case, they're trying to scare them into going for colon cancer screening.
Mm-hmm. And we see and what's the point of that? Is that just to drive people to a doctor or to the hospital, ask your doctor sort of campaign?
Well, I think it has there's probably part of it. I mean, mm-hmm. it is an advertisement for an academic center, but it's also – it's kind of blurs the line between an ad and a public service announcement. They're trying to encourage people to get screened. And in this case, you know, screening for colon cancer, there's, you know, pretty good evidence that it does reduce your chance of dying from colon cancer. Mm-hmm. The problem is that even if there is good evidence, and even if all the experts and all the professional organizations think it's a good thing to do, in the end, it's the individual person who has to go through the exam and, you know, suffer the risks and the harms and the inconvenience for the hope of some benefit. So the individual person is the one who has to weigh these things and decide. And we think getting them to do it by persuading them through, you know, through fear isn't good. We think we should give them information so they can make a reasoned decision on their own.
Well, what we're in this case and in other cases where we're sending people to their doctors, what is wrong if they go and get screened for colon cancer even at an early age?
Well, I think part of it is that we may change people's conception about their health, because let's say they go to get colon cancer, but by this ad they believe that there's an enormous risk of their having colon cancer or dying from colon cancer. One is that they may be unnecessarily afraid of what's going to happen during the test. And also it may start to make them feel more vulnerable, which may disrupt their sense of health. So I guess it's a sort of moral question about what does it mean to be healthy, and how much do we need to scare people to do these things? Or, you know, can we help people to believe that there's a genuine choice, because we know that screening, you know, will help some people, probably not make a difference for most people who were never destined to get it to begin with, and that it may harm some people. And since screening is this sort of complicated, complicated outcomes, it's important that people mm-hmm. be involved in that, and also that they have a realistic sense of what their risks of these things happening are so that they don't feel so vulnerable and sort of unnecessarily worried.
Larry in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. It's an interesting topic. I was just looking at statistics for reactions on a drug, but I have a question on it. It says the range of vax dates. What does that mean? How long it's been in use, or how long its shelf life is? And then I'll have a question.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand
the range,
age of what?
One of the statistics is the range of vax, VAX dates. That's one of the columns.
And what are you reading off of?
I'm reading off a thing called Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System from National Vaccine Information Center.
So VAX would be short for vaccination, right?
I would assume that. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I assumed. Well, looking at statistics, I had one between the years 92 and 94. The statistics show me that there were 94 deaths from a particular period of vaccine, of DPT. Now, what kind of information would I derive from that?
What's the proper time window, I think he's asking? How long should it be to think that you have a good study there, I would imagine?
Well, I think there's more too. I mean, you need – I didn't catch the number, but out of how many? So if there were 10 people who got the vaccine and 9 died, that's one thing. If there were 10 million people who got the vaccine and 9, that's a different thing. Also, how complete was the data collection? Mm-hmm. It's very hard to know what to make of that with so little information. Mm-hmm. If I heard something like that, I would know to ask a lot of questions.
So you want to know how many people were in the study, because many times we see studies and there may be 100 in them, or there may be even fewer, and you want to know how long the study was conducted, and how important is knowing the reputation of the people who do the study? Or do you assume because it's published, it's reputable?
It doesn't mean that it's true just because it's published, and it certainly, even if it's published in a very high-profile journal, it doesn't always mean it's true. Sometimes things are published because they're interesting or they raise questions that people should investigate, but I think on average, things that are published and other scientists have vetted them, and in other words, that they've undergone peer review, are clearly better than things that are unpublished, but I don't think that, it's just because something is published or published in a high-profile journal, that necessarily means that it's true or important.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time. I want to thank you both for being with us today, Lisa Schwartz and Stephen Wallachin. They're both professors at Dartmouth Medical School and a general internist at the Department of Veteran Affairs. And together with Gilbert Welsh, they have co-authored a book called Know Your Chances, Understanding Health Statistics, How to See Through the Hype in Medical News, Ads, and Public Service Announcements. Have a happy new year to both of you.
You too. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.